Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show, and you can find out more information on our website at kalw.org. If you click news, you can find our program, Your Call, there on our website. If you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or call us 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And now we're going to talk about the massive budget bill that just passed the U.S. House of Representatives. It's a plan that's set to slash healthcare, hit the poorest Americans the hardest, and hand even more money via tax cuts to the wealthiest, all while adding nearly $4 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years. There is a lot to unpack in the House budget bill, and to help break it all down and tell us what's really at stake, we're very pleased to be joined by two guests. First, I want to welcome Lucy Dean Stockton, editor and reporter for The Lever News, covering privatization. Good to have you back with us, Lucy.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be back.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Arthur Delaney, a reporter with The Huffington Post, covering politics and the economy. Good to have you back, Arthur.
Great to be here.
So, Speaker Mike Johnson was pushing to get the bill passed before Memorial Day, and it looks like he got his way. There was a lot of back and forth over the past few weeks and a lot of pressure, including from President Trump. In the end, the House narrowly passed this budget bill 215 to 214. Of course, all Democrats voted against it. It's now heading to the Senate. Before we dive in and talk about the major components of the bill and what it might mean for our listeners, for the country at large, I wanted to ask you both just about the media coverage. Do you think that people got to know what's really at stake here and just looking at the media coverage on this? And Lucy, let me start with you on that question.
Sure. I mean, this bill will be a disaster for working people. It rips healthcare away from nearly 14 million Americans. It gets food aid. It jacks up the cost of so many essential parts of life, housing, education, electricity, and it's handing over these huge tax cuts. I do think that the media coverage has focused on the broad strokes of it, tax cuts, social services, but there are also lots of nightmare Easter eggs in the bill, things that will send us backwards on AI regulation, repeal gun safety legislation, regulations, and also make it even harder to get housing in this country, as well as structural changes to the economy, like repealing the Inflation Reduction Act. I also think there may not be enough focus on how many of the lawmakers that are voting for this bill will personally benefit, but I do think that the media did a good job of really focusing on the intra-party disagreements that tended to dominate the coverage.
I appreciate that take. Arthur, your thoughts and any responses to what Lucy has observed?
Well, I'm in the media, and I was covering the bill from the Capitol, so it's hard for me to, you know, I don't think I did a bad job, and the bill is very sprawling, so to convey what it means in a way for people to understand without taking up too much of their time, you basically want to say it's tax cuts, it's Medicaid cuts, it's food benefit cuts, but the tax cuts are the biggest thing, and contrary to one of the main Republican messages over the past decade, they're not even trying to pay for the tax cuts. So they're going to enlarge the deficits that they themselves have said are evil and immoral and will bankrupt the United States. So that's weird. Those are things that I tried to highlight in my stories. And I will say that I feel I was right to do so.
Yes.
I agree. Arthur,
of course, Arthur, we love your coverage. That's why we have you on. So any criticisms of media coverage, of course, are directed to others, not your reporting on this. Just want to be clear. And Arthur, you talked about the big budget deficits, and I mentioned the trillions of dollars as this will add. Is there not a requirement that this has to be revenue neutral to get through the reconciliation process in the U.S. Senate? And if not, how are Republicans sort of spinning the fact that this, you know, supposedly fiscally conservative party is adding so much to our debt?
Well, whenever you think you have a grip on rules for Congress, you have to remember that Congress writes its own rules. So forget that. And what was the second part of your question? I'm sorry.
Well, just how they would sort of spin this politically, or do they even care at this point about the deficits?
They are sensitive to it, and it was deficit concern that threatened the bill's passage, with the whole faction of right-wingers saying, there's no way we're voting for this, and then they basically chickened out after Donald Trump told them they better do it, and Speaker Johnson basically pounded them with the clock by being really fast. But when they are confronted on the deficit widening aspect of the bill, they say, well, the tax cuts are so pro-growth that the economy will rev up, and an accompanying surge of business tax and payroll tax receipts will make up the difference. And nobody believes this. Like, it's a completely fantasy argument that even the Conservative Tax Foundation, which believes strongly in the power of tax cuts to help the economy, not even they will go along with this. So it's a strange situation where they're really making stuff up, and they kind of know it, but they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, we're back to that voodoo economics from 45 years ago. Yeah, Lucy, do you want to comment?
Very much reminiscent of the trickle-down economics that came to prominence in the Reagan era. I mean, something that also is true is that Republicans are talking out of both sides of their mouth here. For decades, they've really been these budget hawks and talking about how bad the national deficit is. But that's only really when it comes to cutting social services. And this bill, like many, many Republican administrations past, will almost definitely grow the national deficit instead of shrinking it. I think the latest estimate is that over the next 10 years, it could grow the deficit by $3.8 trillion. It's also worth mentioning that I think Trump was also saying in the same trickle-down economics theory that we don't have to worry about the deficit because these tax cuts will end up paying for it and balance the whole thing out, is also why he's saying that we can cut social services, because it will grow the economy so much that people won't need these services anymore. He mentioned that the SNAP cuts won't be a problem because the cost of food will go down as the economy revs up. All of that is pretty much debunked by economists, by history, and by social advocates.
Yeah, so everyone's going to be so rich, who needs social services? Well, Lucy, you've talked just on this program here, and I know in the Lever News as well, of just about the impacts to low-income Americans and how this is a wealth transfer in a lot of ways. Can you just maybe at a high level talk about some of the ways that high income earners will get benefits here, and correspondingly, what it might mean for someone who is making $50,000 a year?
Sure. I mean, I think this big, beautiful budget bill, as it's officially called now, the latest estimates from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy said that working class families' taxes will be cut by an average of $361 in the next 2 years, while the highest income families will get an average of $250,000 in tax cuts. And I think what we're seeing is just there will be more and more tax cuts for the wealthiest who have fought for this. And working families will end up paying, if not the same, probably more, especially as the cost of living continues to increase. I think it's also worth mentioning that many of the Republican lawmakers who really pushed this through will personally benefit from a lot of the tax benefits, including Republicans that said they wouldn't vote for it. They actually changed their tune at the very last minute, and almost all of them will benefit from the pass-through deduction that's included in the tax bill. Over 70%, or about 70% of the Republican caucus is set to personally benefit from the tax cuts in this budget bill.
Yeah, such an important angle here that I agree with you has not really been covered. If you're just joining us, this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the House Republican budget that just passed this week. We're getting into the details with Lucy Dean Stockton, editor and reporter for The Lever News, and Arthur Delaney, reporter with HuffPost, covering politics. And the phone lines are open if you have questions about what's in the budget deal, concerns about how this might affect you or your community, or other questions for our guests. The number to call is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. 8255 or email any questions you have to yourcall@kalw.org. Arthur, we were speaking a bit about the impacts of this budget bill on the deficit, how many trillions of dollars it's going to add to the deficit and the national debt. And as we also have discussed, Republicans have sort of consistently claimed that growth will materialize, that will pay for this. But that was, especially over the last few decades, in an era of much lower interest rates. But we've seen now the bond market getting pretty jittery around Trump's tariffs. We've seen threats of higher interest rates. Are Republicans maybe starting to get nervous about the economic impacts and the fiscal impacts, you know, very in a near-term way to having this budget bill? We did see Moody's, for example, downgrade the U.S. So is this playing into the politics at all?
Not a lot. There a couple of the Republicans who were either against or almost against the bill have pointed to the bond market, which is a thing that you know, is sort of new in U.S. politics, at least in the last like 15 years. For example, during the Great Recession, when Congress was debating, you know, like extra unemployment benefits, Republicans would say, you know, this spending is bad, and but there was no bond market threat. Like the idea that the deficits were going to directly harm anybody was really remote and theoretical. And now, after we've had the Great Recession, the COVID pandemic, to which Congress responded with trillions of dollars, there seems to be like an extra antsiness among bond traders. And they are like in recent weeks demanding a higher yield in exchange for buying government debt, meaning they think the government debt is the government's looking a little shaky, and they want more money back for investing in the government debt. And that directly results in things being more, money being more expensive, in higher interest rates for home loans, auto loans, credit cards. And so it's beginning to be a little bit different than it used to be. I think we'll see if it continues like this. But the real world impact of deficit spending seems more noticeable than it had in the last fiscal policy debates.
We've got a caller in from Salinas. Maggie is on the line. Maggie, welcome to your call.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I just would like to do a little pushback on all media. Your call, your guest included, but not to be. Look, what I want to say is it's on messaging. I'm against this bill that they're passing. But every time I hear someone repeat their messaging, which is big, beautiful bill, that's it. It's done. It's over. That's all we hear. Our messaging, they message in short sentences. We message in chapters, essays. Yeah. And we can't do that. Because the public only has so much of an attention span. We only and if the only thing we come away with is big, beautiful bill, the rest is done. No, I mean, we need to be doing a Richie Rich versus a Charlie Brown. They get the billions, and we get a rock. You know, instead of big, beautiful bill, it should maybe be big billionaire bill. You know, just think about that.
Yeah. No, Maggie, I appreciate the question around messaging. Of course, some of this is sort of more political opposition messaging, but in terms of how the media might be playing into this, curious, starting with you, Arthur, and then I want to hear from you, Lucy, too, on that question from Maggie.
I think so they officially named the bill. The bill was always called Big Beautiful Bill as a nickname. And it was kind of a funny nickname because that's like a clumsier, not very clever title. It's not an acronym. But then they officially did name it the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And it's true that if you use that in the headline, it risks sounding like a value judgment on the legislation, because it's just like, it's called the Great Bill. How can you endorse that? And we actually have talked about this at HuffPost and have used Big Beautiful Bill in the headline, but have also, I've preferred to go with tax and spending cut or tax and Medicaid cut bill, because I think those are the two biggest, simplest, most important parts of it.
Yeah, so, and Lucy, go ahead, Lucy. Sorry, Arthur, didn't
yeah,
mean to cut you
Arthur,
off,
but, Oh, no, Arthur, I totally appreciate that. I think it was originally coined from Trump. Maybe it was a Truth Social post, even. He was talking about the budget reconciliation bill that was coming months down the line as his one big, beautiful bill to rule them all. And I think that I certainly have continued to use it somewhat facetiously, and I should probably check myself in being tongue-in-cheek, because I agree that the public only has a limited span for the sort of news that they can take in, which makes sense. You know, it's our jobs and it's not everyone else's jobs. But it's true that it was the official title, and I love the way that you readapted that, Arthur, as referring to it as in different ways. I do think it actually is a sort of recurring problem. You know, senators, lawmakers name their bills all kinds of things. There's another cryptocurrency bill coming down the line right now. It's officially called the Guiding and Establishing National Innovation for U.S. Stablecoins. It's going to be a disaster, I think, in many different ways for the cryptocurrency industry, but it's being called the Genius Act. Everyone's calling it that, and it's far from genius. You know, it will be actually quite damaging. But I think it's important, definitely, to complicate the language that is being fed to us by the actual bill's names as the impact that the audience is receiving.
Yeah, of course, so. This goes back a fair ways. Think of the Patriot Act, for example, also.
Absolutely.
So we have another caller, Greg in Palo Alto, joining us. Greg, welcome to your call. You're on the air.
Hello, thank you. You know, I'm not affected by the fiscal parts of this. What really bothers me is that the human toll that this is going to have is going to be devastating. I mean, you're going to have millions of people thrown off Medicaid. They're going to lose medical coverage. There's other impacts that they're going to have on people in the country. It's going to be devastating. And the surprising thing to me is that the Republicans just don't seem to care. I mean, they know that in their districts, especially in the House, that people are going to be impacted. And they just don't give, well, I won't use the pejorative, but they just seem to be totally indifferent to this. So I think that there's just going to be a lot of suffering and pain, and people are going to really have a hard time trying to get through the next year and a half. And like I said, I'm really surprised that no Republican realizing in the House of Representatives that, hey, I'm going to be throwing my constituents under the bus to put this through. So that to me is the bigger question.
No, thank you, Greg, for raising this point. Lucy, can you talk about some of those provisions that really would have a major toll on some of the most vulnerable in our society?
Sure. I mean, there has been a lot of coverage about Medicaid, and I agree. It's going to be devastating. I think it's almost 80 million people are enrolled between Medicaid programs and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Actually, almost, I think about half of all U.S. kids rely on the program to get healthcare, from checkups to vaccines to reading glasses that they can see with. Medicaid has really, really far-reaching impacts throughout the country, and in many Republican districts, many other Republican lawmakers who voted to approve these enormous cuts will be taking healthcare away directly from their own constituents. I think that there is, I mean, I know that there were some holdouts, you know, like some Republicans have really criticized this as taking this away from their constituents and have put up a fight, although many of them then went on and did an about face for the 1 a.m. vote that they did on this bill. And I do think that there is some awareness that it's going to be very bad for their voting base. But also, I think there was a lot of pressure within the party to get it done, and they were willing to accept those cuts at the behest of Donald Trump. I also do want to say, I think there's something kind of sneaky happening here. With SNAP, at least, many of the cuts won't actually go into effect until 2027, which is after the midterms. You know, there is some real political strategy in play here. And I'm sure Arthur could speak more to that. He's probably following it more closely. But I do think that there's some pretty nefarious strategy happening here. And there is an awareness of just how devastating the human toll is going to be.
Yeah. Arthur, I want to go to you in a second, but I just would point out that the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities notes that roughly 15 million low and moderate income people lose health coverage and become uninsured under this budget measure. But so I want to point that out for listeners. But Arthur, definitely want to get your take as well on the politics of this, delaying the implementation, as Lucy just mentioned, but also how does this impact Republican districts and Republican constituents, and particularly when we think about this moving to the Senate and how this might play into Senate politics?
So there is a rhetorical and maybe psychological way design to the policy that they think is advantageous. So they know that they're cutting Medicaid. And there was a group of Republicans that said, we will not support any Medicaid cuts. They all voted for the bill. But the way the Medicaid cuts works is that Congress doesn't do the cuts itself. The federal government doesn't do it. They set up, for example, work requirements. And then if unemployed people are not able to certify with a state government that they were working or volunteering 20 hours a week, it becomes the unemployed Medicaid or SNAP recipient's own personal choice to disenroll from those programs. So it wasn't Congress that did it, it was you. And there are other larger burdens put on states where states will have to share the cost of a SNAP, federal nutrition benefits, for example. That will give the states a strong incentive to reduce their enrollment since they'll have to be paying for it. And there will be cutbacks to funding for states that use their own money to support undocumented immigrants. States that do that will lose a significant share of their Medicaid funding. If that happened, they would have to look for ways to save. So they set in motion what will result in cuts, but they don't do it themselves. They let the states hold the knife.
Yeah. As we think about the states, this really plays into the next phase of this, which is going to the U.S. Senate. And now you've got representatives, not just from specific districts, but from entire states that are going to be much more sensitive to the statewide impacts. And Lucy, I'm curious if you have thoughts about how that might play into it. And if you also want to add any details that you might have about some of these cuts, particularly to food stamps, supplemental nutrition assistance programs.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I just want to again highlight what Arthur just brought up about how this will be shunted to the states, because states also have a different budget balancing process where they actually are much more cash strapped. They can't print more money like the federal government does, and so they need to have a balanced budget. And it means that for programs, for example, like things like housing, which has also gotten much less attention in the budget, but includes $26 billion in sweeping cuts to federal rental assistance programs to keep the most vulnerable Americans housed, that funding will be slashed by 40%. And then it will be left to states to try and make up the difference. What's crazy is that the budget puts this almost in the language of empowering states is what it's called. The Trump administration released some public announcements about it and said that the budget empowers states by transforming the current federal dysfunctional assistance programs into a state-based grant. Mm-hmm. As if it's actually good for them. And I think it is also, again, a pretty nefarious way to do it, mm-hmm. because it also means that many states will now have much, much higher budgets. I think in trying to make up the difference for SNAP, this includes many Republican states that will be forced to foot the bill. I think Florida over the next like 10 years will mm-hmm. be forced to cover a $15 billion budget gap that the federal government used to cover for SNAP and now won't.
It really passes so much of this burden onto those state governments, as you just described. Almost out of time, but Arthur, as we think about this moving to the Senate, what are you hearing about the politics there? What can we look for in terms of how this debate will play out in that chamber of our legislative branch?
I was in the Senate yesterday and to get everyone's reactions to the bill passing the House and it being thrown on their plate. And it's very similar dynamic where a bunch of senators have different gripes about the bill. We saw that in the House, and you know, by their own logic, their different priorities were just irreconcilable. ultimately Donald Trump told them to stop squabbling and do it. And I think that that will be the same result in the Senate, even though they themselves say that's not what will happen. I would not bet on this really falling apart. There will be a bunch of changes, though. It will be like a real headache for the Republicans, and it could take longer than July 4th, which is the goal that they've set for themselves. But they'll probably wind up getting it done. I don't know if they'll water down the tax cuts or supercharge them by changing the way they account for their cost, or if they'll get the steeper spending cuts that the right wingers want, or more likely less steep ones. But there'll be a lot of changes. I think that they have momentum, though.
So there's a lot to cover here. I just want to thank you both for helping to unpack a bit of the provisions. A lot more we can cover, and I'm sure we will on this program. But I want to thank you, Lucy Dean Stockton, editor and reporter for The Lever News. Thank you for joining us on Your Call.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I also want to thank Arthur Delaney, reporter with HuffPost covering politics. Thank you, Arthur, for coming back and talking about this bill.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for the callers.
Absolutely. Thank you to all our listeners for sure. That's our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit the Your Call page at kalw.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where we always appreciate a review. And you can follow us on social media or email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Billy Hay Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind. It's Your Call.